Thank you, Liam. So the final session of the day, as you know, is on fiscal policy. We've got a stellar lineup of speakers from around the country. In alphabetical order, we have Seamus Coffey, whose must-read blog, Economic Incentives, is from UCC. Philip Lane, who's done much to drive the fiscal reform agenda here, from Trinity. Colin McCarthy, who writes two columns a week, influential columns a week, from UCD, and John McHale, who's chairman of the Independent Fiscal Council, and he's from UCG. The running order will be Philip Lane first, and then John McHale. We'll take those back to back, and because the subject area is quite similar, then we'll take 10 minutes of questions on their presentations before going to the next two and then taking a final 10 minutes. So I'll invite Philip to open proceedings.
Okay, my plan when I knew about this conference was to talk about the Fiscal Responsibility Bill, which was, at that point, was going to be published by the end of quarter one. That's been pushed back for very good reasons to the end of quarter two. So, and the reason why it's been pushed back is all of this action at the European level. One element of that is this so-called fiscal compact. Now, what I'm going to say is a little bit speculative because we haven't seen the official version of it. I saw somewhere on the internet today, it might be on Monday. But it's worth thinking about this issue about should we care? Is it really going to make a big difference? And what are the nitty-gritty elements of it? So before I get to that, it's just worth briefly reminding ourselves why we have all of this hoopla about fiscal governance. Essentially, it's to avoid some of the historical patterns which have been in many countries. It's not unique to Ireland by any means. Coming up with a level of public debt that is excessive and imposes a big burden. Avoiding pro-cyclicality. So now we have this big fiscal squeeze in the middle of a recession. Not a very nice pattern. But of course, one reason for that, pro-cyclicality in a recession, is pro-cyclicality in the good years when not enough of a surplus was run. So the issue is, well, these are chronic problems. Maybe we can do something about it by changing the way fiscal policy is made, in particular if you have a kind of legalistic fiscal framework. Now, what I'm going to say is going to focus on that, but any discussion of that has to say this is a secondary issue. Legal frameworks only work if there's the political will. So you do need a lot of political buy-in, both in terms of the political system and the wider public, because any legal system can be manipulated with fiscal data. Really, when you talk about a fiscal framework, the idea is there's really two lines of defense. One is domestic, because fiscal policy, in the end, is primarily a domestic issue. So do you have domestic institutions to avoid these problems? And then the second line of defense is if the domestic framework is not working, the EU will step in, and it will step in not just because it wants to help out, but there are genuine fiscal spillovers. We've seen in this crisis plenty of contagion. And if you like, one of the issues in the first version of the euro was the EU level was there sort of, but it's too crude, it's too extreme to operate on a regular basis. What you need is the first level of defense, and that was a missing link. Now, it's not just about fiscal policy. The issue is, if you have a credible fiscal framework, so money types can be assured that these excessive debt levels will not come again, then maybe there's more of a role for a central bank. I think the German view is you cannot have routine access to the central bank, but maybe a little bit temporarily is okay, so long as we're sure we can be guaranteed that the long-run fiscal position is sustainable. It's a precursor for fiscal federalism. There's not a huge amount of appetite for US-style fiscal federalism until each member of the federation is shown to be a good citizen. And in the same way, even if you don't want fiscal federalism, if all you want is joint bond issuance, the classic objection to that is bad behavior by some individual government. Again, if you have a fiscal framework, it's a precursor to that. So even though in itself this is not maybe super important, it maybe opens the door to a lot of other things. So this has been recognized here in many ways, both A lot of parties had individual elements of this in their manifestos going back a while. The Oireachtas Committee had a report in November 2010, and I was involved in writing the background paper for that. Then they, it was part of the Troika agreement in, you know, 2 weeks later to have this fiscal responsibility framework. As I say, the legal framework is now pushed back to the end of June. I'm sure John will talk about the report IFAC just released yesterday. IFAC is there now on a interim basis. And, you know, so given this big domestic process, which has been ongoing, now it's a little bit coming to a pause because of the fact, look what's happening at the European level and how should we rethink what's going on domestically. And so here's my chronology. There's a lot going on, so I may have missed some elements here. But in terms of what you need to really read is the six-pack, various iterations of that. But in the end, the official guiding structures were released on November 16. And so fiscal policy, there are three regulations. So this essentially, all European governments have to follow these regulations. And then there's a fiscal directive, which has to be transposed into local law. And that's what the fiscal responsibility bill, that's one reason to have that. Now, there's other things going on in six-pack to do with excessive imbalances, whether it's external or internal, which I'll come back to. So that's already done. That's there. That's a guiding framework. A week later, there's released further documentation by the Commission. The Green Paper on Stability Bonds got some attention, but there are two further regulations on fiscal governance, which have not yet been accepted. I don't know how many months that takes, but they're proposed, and I'll come back to that. And then we had the extra component of the fiscal compact at the December summit. And we've seen one or two leaks of it, and I'll talk about that now, but we haven't seen the final version. So the fiscal compact, from if you've read the 7 or 8 pages version of it, is extremely general, and you might say, well, that sounds a bit worrying. What does that really mean? But you have to read it in the context of the six-pack regulations. In fact, we know quite a bit about what they mean when they talk about structural balance and so on, because all of that is in great detail in the regulations in the six-pack. So, you know, the structural balance, which is Article 3 in the leaked version, your imbalance is if you're meeting your medium-term budget objective. So what is that? Well, first of all, it's going to be country specific. But there are some indicators that, the, you know, in terms of structural balance, the typical example is the target can't be a deficit greater than 0.5% of GDP. But in fact, if you are a low risk country, so your debt has gone well below 60 and other indicators look okay, then a 1% deficit is okay. So that is still more or less the guiding framework. So 0.5 is only for you know, the kind of risky type countries. You might converge to the 1% target. Now, of course, you're not going to be there maybe initially. We're not there initially, depending on how you define these things. So there's also the idea that you need to have a steady pace of convergence. So if you're away from that target, you have to improve your position by 0.5% a year. And then the other kicker here is, you know, every year the fiscal outcomes can be different to what you plan. That is a correction mechanism. That if deviations accumulate, that there's a way to fix that drift. So that's about the budget balance. And then in terms of debt levels, Article 4 is important also. It says that if debt is above 60%, the 1/20th rule will get you back down, where 1/20th of the excess over 60 gets eliminated every year. So this is going to be the way fiscal policy is supposed to be run now. So number one is, it is country specific. There's not a unique target for all countries. What your target for the budget balance should be will change every 3 years. So this lines up with medium-term budget planning and so on, that the target is at every 3 years set. There is an issue about aligning that with the electoral cycle, because presumably every new government will also want to have a view about its targets. What the right number is it 0, is it +1, is it +3, is it -0.5, is it -1? will depend on the level of debt. It will depend on demographics. You know, do you face a big aging problem that you should be saving up for, and other economic targets? So this is going to be, I think, a big issue, because economics doesn't tell you what the right level of public debt is. So there's a trade-off between consumption today and consumption in the future. There's an issue about optimal public investment. There's a simple discounting. How, you know, if you have a political system where you have a political party representing essentially older groups and a younger group political system, you know, what the right level of public debt will be a contested issue. So this is going to be, you know, this language is going to be important. It's important to say this is a budget balance target. It's consistent, it's silent on what the right level of public spending to GDP is. So it can veer from a low size of government to a high size of government. That's all fine. It just means if you want to spend a lot, eventually you have to collect the taxes to pay for it. So relative to simpler budget balance rules, which looked at the overall target, having the structural target means you don't have to worry about the pro-cyclicality in the sense of the cyclical adjustment, the automatic stabilizers. But I have to say, this is a tiny issue. The cyclical adjustment is tiny for most countries. You need a gigantic output gap, because the coefficient here is 0.4. So, you know, a 5 percentage point output gap, which is pretty big, gives you a 2% deficit, increasing the deficit. So this is not, you know, automatic stabilizers for Ireland are just so weak compared to the overall volatility of the economy that this is not the core issue. So I'll come back to that. There's a difference between the cyclically adjusted balance and the structural balance, one-off and temporary measures, and we've had plenty of those here through the, you know, bank bailout and all of that. You have to read this in the context of the six-pack. The six-pack has a lot about broad macroeconomic balance, external balance, internal balance, and so on. And that is centrally involved here. And in part, I think that allows for quite a bit of activism. So what that means is, let's say your economy is rocketing. The cyclical component of the budget balance is only going up a little bit. And, you know, the question is, you know, listen, do we really think that's enough? Maybe we should be preemptively cooling down this economy. And if you preemptively build up extra surpluses in the good years, the six-pack says you can spend those in the bad years. So we could, in principle, have budget balances here, you know, plus 5 or 6 in the good years, minus 5 or 6. No problem having minus 5 or 6 overall balance here, so long as you've built up the extra surpluses in the good years. So it is not a constraint on cyclical management of the economy, so long as you do it on the good years as well as the bad years. It's also the case you could use fiscal to cool down the housing market, preempt current account imbalances. You could also do it to tackle, say, competitiveness issues. So it's really very flexible in that sense. All it's trying to do is avoid high debt, excessive debt, and pro-cyclicality. Counter-cyclicality will be okay here, so long as it's symmetric. One issue which is fundamental and which does require change here is some kind of correction mechanism. So in the Department of Finance report from a year ago, when they laid out here's more or less what the fiscal responsibility bill will look like, it was all about intentions. So every year the government would have to announce a budget that looked okay. If it turned out badly, well, that was last year's budget, you know, bygones are bygones. Whereas the European Commission, and I think rightly, says if you overborrow, you need to work that in to pay that back over time. So there's a control account concept where you keep track of those forecast errors. And the German and Swiss examples have that. On the debt reduction rule, of course, this is the equation that all of us will carry around and we'll be able to automatically repeat. There will be a quiz in the Q&A. The Q&A will be for us to ask you questions. It's essentially the moving average of, you know, get down your debt by 120 every year, when the reference debt is last year's debt, year mostly the year before that. The last one should be BT minus 3. And again, relative to the current fiscal responsibility bill, and John's report also points us out, is a debt reduction target is better than what's currently in the fiscal responsibility bill, which is a cyclically adjusted primary surface target. Because the right primary surface to run to get your debt down depends on what the growth rate is and the interest rate. Who knows what that's going to be 10 years from now or 20 years from now. So if you want to get the debt down, get the debt down. Legislate for a number that may be inappropriate. A big one is in the saying independent forecasts should be referred to. That's in the six pack. And they're saying you can either use a European Commission forecast or use an independent forecast, but in the six pack you're still free to let the Department of Finance pick a number. In the November 23 proposed legislation, it's rock solid. It has to be an independent forecast. So again, this idea now where the Department of Finance and the government says, here's our growth forecast, that cannot be. And that's not in the fiscal responsibility field right now. In Germany, they made a decision, we're not going to bother. We just take the European Commission number. So in the German constitutional law, it says the European Commission's number will be used. Now, since Germany is a big part of the euro area and the Commission mostly tries to get the euro area correct, that's maybe okay. The Commission's methodology may not be perfect for Ireland. So then the question is, who should do it? Should we have the Central Planning Bureau in the Dutch style and relatedly the Office of Budget Responsibility from the UK? Both of those are distinct in the sense that they're just doing a forecast. They're not saying what the right policy should be. They're just saying, here's what we think the economy should go in a kind of technocratic way. Maybe the Fiscal Council could do it, but then it has to be Mark II of the Fiscal Council, where they have the mandate to do it, which they don't currently have, and they have the resources to do it. You could look at the ESRI, and you could also look at the central bank. Central bank might be the right place to do it. That debate, you know, has to get going here. So that I think is a big issue, because right now the only real number the Europeans look at is the European Commission forecast. And you need a formal local analysis to compete with that. So, you know, as I've gone along, it's been a little bit explanatory saying, what does the fiscal compact mean? To me, I'm fairly relaxed about its impact on the Irish system, because a lot of what's in there was going to be done anyway for domestic reasons. My interpretation of what Europe wants is it's a second line of defense. And the second line of defense should only be relevant for failing states. Hopefully Ireland is not in that context, but there might be other European countries where essentially the local governance system fails and you get really bad fiscal outcomes, and which cause contagion. That is really all that this is about. But you know, when you have a legal structure, you have to work that structure. So a lot of it is about communication. So rather than the government framing the budget in terms of political objectives, there's going to be a big technocratic element saying, well, you know, we think, or the Office of Budget Responsibility thinks the potential output gap is X. Therefore, we model the structural balance. So the whole language of fiscal policy will become much more technocratic. So it's great. It's great for professional economists. It's great for our students. It's a real jobs scheme for macro and fiscal economists. So, you know, on that basis, we have to support it. And then just finally, all of this, again, it's an interesting experiment of these fiscal frameworks. But in the end, governments can get around this. So the other half of this, which is, do politicians really believe in low public debt? Do they really believe in countercyclicality? That's for the politicians to work out. Okay, thanks.
So thank you very much, Philip. You may think that having two presentations back-to-back on fiscal institutions is a cruel and unusual punishment, but I think the reason we can get away with it today is that there certainly is a lot of attention being given to these matters. So the background for my presentation is a report that's just been released by the Fiscal Council. When the Council was set up, we were asked to provide input into the upcoming Fiscal Responsibility Bill. As Philip said, the bill was supposed to be published at the end of last year. With European developments, it's been delayed until the end of the second quarter of this year. So what we're really responding to in our report are the Department of Finance proposals for stronger Irish fiscal institutions. But of course, the whole situation is evolving, so in the presentation today, I will try to take into account the negotiations over the fiscal compact. So the report itself focuses not just on rules, but on the permanent design of the Fiscal Council, but because of the time constraints here, I'm just going to focus on the rules. And in particular, talk about what's required for an effective set of fiscal rules. And I think there'll be a lot of overlap with Philip's conclusions. And in particular, I'm going to focus on the importance of flexibility to a good set of rules. We're going to look actually very quickly at the Department of Finance proposals and then bring things up to date with the treaty developments. So I'm going to begin by outlining the rationale for having fiscal rules. At the moment, such rules are seen as something that are really being imposed from the outside, and there's been a huge backlash. But there are cases to be made, and Philip began making them. Of course, there's been international concern, not just in Ireland, but across many industrialized countries, about poor fiscal performance in recent decades, both in terms of deficit and debt biases. It took a particular form in Ireland during the boom. It wasn't a deficit problem, but or at least an open deficit problem, but there was a big hidden structural deficit, given that you had rapid expenditure increases that were being funded by what certainly turned out to be unsustainable tax revenues that were based on a property bubble. So the background is this concern over fiscal performance. There's not total agreement, certainly, amongst macroeconomists on what good fiscal policy is, but there is a large amount of agreement, and we can identify three particular principles of good, of sound macroeconomic fiscal management. That is to make sure that your debt is sustainable and that you can retain creditworthiness, that the basic fiscal system is stable in the sense of keeping relatively constant tax and benefit rates over time in terms of intergenerational fairness, and also in terms of efficiency. If you have rapidly changing taxes, that can be very inefficient, given that the distortions associated with taxes tend to rise in a nonlinear way. And then the third principle is really countercyclicality, and that is particularly important when you can't use monetary policy for macroeconomic stabilization purposes. It's very important to be able to use fiscal policy. It's something that Frank Barry emphasized in his presentation. So that's what good fiscal policy is. We know both from the empirical evidence, but also from the economics behind this, that there are many biases in the actual implementation of fiscal policy and deviation from these principles. Now, I could spend the whole talk talking about these, but I don't have time, so I'll just note them here. But because of various biases under complete political discretion, you tend to have a bias towards deficits that are too high, and also over time debts that are too high. So the idea of fiscal institutions is to try to narrow the gap between the good fiscal policy and the actual fiscal policy. And there are various types of fiscal institutions, fiscal rules and fiscal agencies being two notable types that are the focus of our report. But the common theme is that the fiscal institutions hopefully narrow the gap between the good and the actual by raising the cost of unsound fiscal management. So that's the national case, so the domestic case, as Philip referred to it. But there also is really the collective case, or in our case, the European case. I think this is very important, and I want to stress it here, because I think it too often gets left out of the debate. There's a need for mutual insurance within a monetary union. This is the whole issue, for instance, relating to the need for a lender of last resort. And when there is mutual insurance, there are spillovers from bad behavior onto other countries because they have to bail you out. So there's a need for shared discipline. And it's not just that other countries are demanding us to be disciplined in our fiscal policies, but we have a big interest in other countries being disciplined in their fiscal policies as well. And what's particular about the current situation is that the degree of mutual insurance that's possible, so for instance, the strength of a lender of last resort, whether it's by the European Central Bank or through the ESM or whatever it is conditional on arrangements for shared discipline. And that's what we're really seeing at the moment. And this is where I would disagree maybe a little bit with Frank. I saw you somewhere over there earlier in terms of, I think he sort of downplayed the importance of the lender of last resort aspect in this debate. Absolutely, a fiscal compact constrains the ability to do countercyclical policy, but it can be essential to make sure that that lender of last resort is in place. And we've seen that the lack of an effective lender of last resort has been a big part of the escalating crisis, particularly in the latter part of last year. So I think there's a rationale for fiscal rules, so we shouldn't dismiss them out of hand, but the devil very much is in the details, and the challenge is to design a good set of fiscal rules, because there's no doubt but that a bad set of fiscal rules can do more harm than good. And the key trade-off involved is this trade-off between flexibility and credibility. On flexibility, you need to balance these sometimes competing principles of sound fiscal management. So for instance, when you're having major creditworthiness problems, but you're also in recession, the principle of sustainability and the principle of countercyclicality can pull in different directions, and good fiscal management needs to balance those. On the other hand, if you have too much wiggle room in your rules, they will lack credibility because it's going to be very hard to enforce them. But on the other hand, if you have too little flexibility and they lead to really silly fiscal policy decisions that are completely inappropriate to your economy, that can cause the rules to lack credibility as well. So what we're really interested in this report is seeing ways in which you can design rules that both give you the necessary flexibility and also the necessary enforcement. So what we were responding to were Department of Finance proposals and actually draft heads of the Fiscal Responsibility Bill in terms of a set of fiscal rules. I'm not actually going to talk a lot about them, partly because they really have been sort of superseded by the European developments. I think they're still an important part of the debate, but I think we will be moving away from them because of the requirements of the fiscal compact. But just to give you a sense of what the Department of Finance rules look like, there was, for instance, a public finance correction rule. So if either the debt was above 90% of GDP or the deficit was above 3% of GDP, you would be required to do 1.5 percentage points of GDP of fiscal consolidation. Then as the debt fell below 90% and the deficit fell below 3%, that required consolidation declined to 3/4 of a percentage point of GDP. And then there were a number of other rules as well, including a sustainable expenditure growth rule, which said that you could only increase your expenditure at the rate of your underlying potential output growth unless you were willing to fund the excess with discretionary tax increases. So there's a set of deficit and expenditure-related rules. Now, others have managed to avoid any sorts of equations, but there is, as any of you have been following this debate, there is a workhorse equation that sort of everybody uses in this case that's really central to thinking about these issues. And it shows the link, really, between the debt and deficits. So it's this key dynamic relationship. So D here is the debt-to-GDP ratio, I is the nominal interest rate, G is the nominal growth rate, and PB is the primary balance or primary surplus expressed as a share of GDP. And it can also be written very simply, noting that the deficit itself, D, which is this DEF here, is equal to the interest component and the primary deficit. It can be written very simply in that second line. It's just the difference between the deficit we just subtract off the growth rate and the lag debt to GDP ratio. So it's just very useful to see this link between the deficit and how the debt evolves over time as we examine different types of fiscal rules. So let's say the rule imposes some target for the deficit. It could be, for instance, a 0.5% of GDP target, this golden rule target that we hear about a lot. We can see what that would imply over time. So this is basically assuming that you get right to that target immediately, and then over time, as your debt falls, you move to some steady state debt to GDP ratio. So given our equation, we have that deficit target, let's say 0.5% of GDP, and we can calculate the steady state debt to GDP ratio that you're converging towards by just dividing that deficit target by the nominal growth rate. And this is something that Colm and Carl Whelan have emphasized. And that if that deficit target is too low for any sort of reasonable nominal growth rate, it implies that you're going to end up with this incredibly low steady state debt to GDP ratio that just really doesn't seem to be warranted. So that's one concern, but I think there are other more immediate concerns as well. So let's say we start off at some particular debt to GDP ratio, and we currently have a large deficit and primary deficit, so the debt is actually rising, not falling, which is the situation we're in at the moment. We can see the path that you would follow as you followed some consolidation path where you actually lowered the primary deficit over time. At some point in time, your debt peaks, and then you come down until you actually hit this transition path, which is what happens when you actually reach that deficit target. Now, why is all this of any use? But for us, it's because it allows us to identify the key flexibilities in designing a good set of rules. First of all, flexibility in terms of those required consolidations. If those required consolidations are not in cyclically adjusted terms, they could really force unnecessarily harsh fiscal adjustment on you in a recession. So let's say you had to do a consolidation equal to 1.5 percentage points of GDP. That could be incredibly difficult if you also had to make up for the increase in the deficit as a result of automatic stabilizers. As Philip said, maybe those automatic stabilizer effects may not be huge in the context of the Irish economy, but they're big enough and could make the adjustment much more difficult. So a first flexibility is to make sure that consolidation requirements are in cyclically adjusted terms. A second issue that comes out of this graph is that if you set your targets too stringently, they could force you into a situation where you have to run very, very large primary surpluses at the same time, while you still have quite a high debt. So you could be running primary surpluses of maybe 6, 7% of GDP, and also would have a very fast rate of decline in your debt to GDP ratio. Unnecessarily fast, possibly if you're also grappling poor economic growth as well. So a second key flexibility would be to put a limit on the rate of debt to GDP reduction that you're forced to pursue. So in terms of this diagram, once you get to that red line, you start cutting across, limiting the amount of additional consolidation you have to do, but still ensuring that you are on a very steep debt reduction path. So that could be, let's say, 3 percentage points of GDP. So it's not as if you're not engaging in improving your underlying fiscal situation, but it's just putting an important limit on what could be demanded of you. And then in terms of the problem of having too low a steady state debt to GDP ratio, a key flexibility would be as your debt came down, would be to relax your deficit target so that steady state debt to GDP ratio rose. So that's on the design of the rules themselves, and there are key flexibilities that we think should be imposed, should be allowed. On enforcement, the Department of Finance proposals are actually quite weak, basically saying that they either sort of comply, and if they don't comply with the rules, they explain. And it's all about their prospective plans and why in their plans they don't intend to actually comply with the rules as laid out. And that is, as you can see, actually quite a weak form of enforcement. So in addition to having the flexibility, you can improve the credibility of the framework by strengthening the enforcement. So we suggest putting the principles of sound fiscal policy in legislation, following, for instance, a New Zealand model, putting at least certain rules in legislation. Each new government should lay out a 5-year debt reduction target, then make annual fiscal statements in terms of not only the prospective plans, but also the retrospective performance in meeting their targets, and it should be assessed by the Fiscal Council. Now, to a large extent, the Department of Finance approach has been superseded by the treaty developments. I think they have much fewer degrees of freedom in putting in place this quite distinct set of fiscal rules. Philip went through the emerging European approach, which is not just related to the treaty, but of course related to the developments last year with the six-pack as well. But the key elements in Article 3 of the treaty are the structural balance target, the golden rule, and also more specifically the medium-term objective, as Philip discussed. There's an adjustment path, which comes out very clearly in the most recent draft of the treaty, that will be determined by the Commission. And this is something that we're already very familiar with the excessive deficit procedure, which tells us how fast we have to get our deficit down. This is the path down to getting our deficit to 3% of GDP by 2015. And the really new thing that comes out of the treaty, and that's what's really, I think, relevant to the debate about the fiscal compact, is this idea that if there are deviations from the adjustment path or the underlying targets, eventually, once you get there, there must be a mechanism that's laid down in national law to correct those deviations. And the correction mechanism itself is to be designed according to principles laid down by the Commission, which, as far as I know, at least, we haven't seen what those principles are. But that really is the big sort of innovation or novelty involved. So just to put that in the picture, if you have some starting deficit, as we have at the moment, about 10% of GDP, some sort of deficit target, the Commission gives you some adjustment path down to that target. As you deviate from that adjustment path, that deviation has to be the focus of a correction, and that correction mechanism is what will have to be in national law. So flexibility remains critical to the application of this, and here I absolutely agree with Philip, who emphasized not just the importance of flexibility, but I think also the possibilities for flexibility within the European framework. But even though the possibilities are there, maybe I'm just a little less sure that flexibility would be used or be allowed to be used, and I think that is critical. So the flexibility still is important in terms of the way the consolidation takes place and cyclical sensitivity in that. Setting in place a reasonable adjustment path towards these longer-term targets, and indeed to relax the structural deficit targets as debt reaches safer levels. Now, it's already in the proposal that the target could rise to 1% of GDP, but that's nowhere near enough to avoid getting down to these unnecessarily low steady-state debt-to-GDP levels. Yeah, 2 minutes should be perfect. The relevance of the proposed treaty is less really in the substantive additional rules that it implies. It is, as Philip said, very much sort of higher level stuff, and the detail is already in place in the Stability and Growth Pact and the reforms to it with the six-pack. And then, as I said, the main innovation is the use of national law to enforce corrections. And this is coming about really because of dissatisfaction with the failures of European-level enforcement, particularly under the Stability and Growth Pact, to really discipline fiscal policy. Now, the European enforcement mechanisms have been strengthened a lot themselves within the six-pack, but it's felt that there needs to be this additional level of enforcement and protection to make sure that countries follow reasonably disciplined fiscal policies. The most recent draft says that this correction mechanism must have binding force and permanent character and preferably constitutional. We all agree with the Irish Constitution that the constitutional route is a very bad idea. We put huge rigidities into fiscal policy, and that's besides the political problems of actually getting it passed. So the legal challenge, and this is for lawyers, not economists, is to come up with some sort of a formulation that has binding force, that shouldn't be a problem, as legislation has binding force, but it can convince others in Europe that the law does have a permanent character. The problem, of course, with legislation is that it can be changed, so there may have to be something else, some additional commitments to give, to make people feel comfortable that it meets these requirements. So, just in conclusion then, there's a need for a greater understanding of the implications of rule designs. I think the idea that rules are all bad or all good is not the way to approach this. Rules can be useful, but we really have to design them properly for them to be useful, so we really have to pay attention to the details. We have to recognize that most of the European rules machinery is already in place, so it's not as if this fiscal compact is really now putting in place this whole new set of rules. Most of it really is already there. It's really these relatively small, well, these, I shouldn't say that because they are quite important, but it's these correction mechanisms that I talked about that are the innovation. Just referring to or returning to a point that I made earlier, we cannot avoid the fact that these mutual insurance mechanisms, including the European Stability Mechanism, the ECB purchase of bonds, eventually the possibility of euro bonds, are likely to be conditional on effective rules. And pretending that's not the case, that we can talk about rules as if the existence of these mechanisms, in particular lender of last resort, is just, I think we're deluding ourselves. And we can see already that the ESM and access to funds through the ESM is being made conditional of having signed up to the fiscal compact. And that's actually being built in to the revised ESM treaty that will be ratified in the coming months. But going as we really implement this, the key will be the flexible implementation of the European rules. I think that the flexibility is there, but I think it will take vigilance, and this is something that we really should push to make sure that the flexibility that's possible within the context of the European rules is actually applied. Thanks.
Okay. I'm conscious, just with time, we've gone over the 10 minutes, but I'm conscious that you had your hand up from very early on, so we'll come back to the next round. Could we move on to the next speakers, and if it comes up, if this issue on fiscal matters is still very much live at that point on the two presentations, we can bring it in as well. So we'll pass over to James.
So thanks very much, Dad. So in this little session here, I'm going to look at some issues in relation to current and capital expenditure. Perhaps first start at sort of an aggregate level in the economy before looking at the differences and patterns between them in a government, say, in a public setting. And I suppose as the day has progressed, we've sort of been welcomed by the success that the day has had. And I was just during the break there, I noticed that the Twitter feed has been spammed. So I think undoubtedly the event is a success if it's attracting that much attention. But just to start with this picture here, which I suppose needs no introduction, that being the GDP pattern of Ireland for the last number of years. I've done the statistician's cheat and affected the axis, so the drop isn't as dramatic as would be suggested here. But overall, we had a drop of about 17% in nominal GDP over the past 3 or 4 years. So looking at this, what has been the driving cause of the drop from about 189 billion at the peak in 2007 to just under 156 billion in 2010, with most estimates that nominal GDP will be largely unchanged or maybe a small drop for 2011. So looking at one of the components that I'll focus on, that being investment, and here the drop isn't being influenced by the choice of access. This graph starts at zero and shows us investment in Ireland for the past 9 years up to 2010. The starting point, 2002, is just the start of the data. There is no significant point to the starting point. It just goes as far as the CSO have provided data on an institute or on a sector basis. So we can break down who has done the investing in the economy and what's been happening in the different sectors. So investment in Ireland nominally peaked in 2007. About 48 billion, when our GDP was 189 billion, was made up of investment, gross fixed capital investment. And that has dropped and dropped like a stone over the last number of years and dropped below 20 billion in 2010. Perhaps we felt it couldn't get any lower. We've just tracked the aggregates in the quarterly national accounts that have been released so far for 2011. Investment in 2011 will be lower yet again. Much of the drop we saw in the Q3 when there was a return to negative growth for Q3 was driven by investment. across the other components of GDP, there was relative stability. Not a lot happening, neither going up nor going down, but investment continued to plummet. So the change in investment has been quite dramatic, and the change here is about 30 billion. So with a drop in nominal GDP of maybe 35 billion, this is telling a lot of the story. There has been changes in the other components. Clearly consumption and the contribution of government current expenditure have been negative, and they've been largely offset by the change in net exports driven by the activities of the multinational sector. So if we look at the CSO's breakdown by sector, who was doing the investment that got us up to 48 billion? Who has stopped investing has dropped us down to less than 20? We can see that the dominant sector in terms of the increase was the household sector. Right through the decade where investment was increasing, it was driven by the household sector. Increase in fixed capital investment, basically buying new houses or investing in improvements in existing houses. So that drove investment from just over 10 billion to over 25 billion in the household sector. The changes in the other two categories weren't that dramatic. Business investment, both non-financial and financial, although mainly non-financial, did increase and has dropped quite dramatically. And government investment, being the lowest of the three, doesn't show huge changes in the numbers, but in relative terms has shown substantial changes. So the main reason for the increase was the household sector. So when investment shot up and went at huge rates, it was us buying new houses. That was what was contributing to the growth in investment. And that then has dropped and dropped quite dramatically. So the household sector has gone from being the largest source of investment in the economy to the smallest source in a very rapid period of time, in a period of just 3 or 4 years. The other two sectors have dropped as well. One impact of this is how much are we actually adding to the capital stock that we have, say, purchasing and additions to the capital stock, but you also have depreciation, the wearing out of what we already have. And if we're not investing sufficient to cover depreciation, what exactly is happening? And we can see in two of the sectors that one is just barely covering depreciation. Household investment has dropped to the stage where it's approaching zero if we look at net investment. And in the business sector, it's negative. So that drop has taken investment in the business sector below negative. The one sector that is adding to the capital stock, or at least was up to 2010, is the government sector. That although there had been a drop in investment, it wasn't dropping below the wear and the depreciation of the existing stock of assets that the state had, that the government had. So the drop in GDP, if you want to look and pinpoint one particular sector, what has caused it, has been driven hugely by a drop in investment. And we can look at different reasons as to why that happened, maybe different policy responses. But clearly it's not, in the traditional sense, responding to interest rates. If you cut interest rates, you might be able to stimulate or generate investment. In 2007, 2008, the ECB rate got up to 4.25%. It's dropped and been relatively low for most of that period. It's now at record lows of 1%. So the interest rate isn't sufficient to stimulate investment, particularly in the household and firm sector, which perhaps would be more responsive to interest rates and perhaps might take a shorter term view. Maybe the government could take a longer term view and wouldn't be as determined by activities on the interest rate side of things. Just looking at what we invested in, again, the CSO break it down. Clearly, when looking at the household sector, the key area for investment in the household sector will be houses. So dwellings dominates our investment. So purchasing new houses and improvements in existing ones. And that mainly what drove the increase again. The other sectors, a bit of noise going on, not a lot happening. But really the dramatic drop in our GDP is hugely influenced by the collapse in the property sector. That activity has gone from being way overheated to virtually stopped. And that has caused a dramatic drop in across a whole range of the sectors in the economy. That the activity here has had knock-on effects elsewhere. If we just want to isolate one that's happening at the bottom, there's this category that's other. In fact, that other is made up of 80% costs involved in transfer of land and business land and buildings. So it's again related to the property sector. And that got up over 5 billion in 2006 related to legal issues in terms of transfer, leases, the creation, the purchase of leases, the purchase of freehold leases from leasehold agreements. And they added substantially to the capital stock. You were generating an asset that could be used. And again, that activity has dropped. So across a whole range of areas, the impact on our national accounts and our GDP figures are quite substantial. So when looking at the overall economy, We clearly will get a lot of emphasis on what's happening on the current side, be it current government expenditure, current expenditure by households, but by far the greatest changes have been on the capital side, that we've stopped spending in most areas across for investment in fixed capital. If we look at the government sector, which is where we're going to focus on the start there, as I started to introduce what it is we're looking at. So looking at the CSO's data on government investment over the past 7 or 8 years up to 2010, we can see the gap between the amount of money the government was spending, and we'll look in more detail at what the government spends its fixed capital budget on, and the depreciation that was occurring. So that's the actual data we have. We can make a fair guess about what public investment was in 2011. We can look at the exchequer return. And then we also have the medium-term fiscal framework to tell us, well, what's planned for the next number of years, given the constraints we find ourselves in, the spending envelopes that we've laid out, how much money we're going to spend, how much of that is going to go on public investment on the capital stock. So what decline we've had over the last number of years is largely set to continue. That with public investment peaking at about $9 billion in 2008, it's going to drop to about $3 billion over the period from 2013, 2014, 2015. So a drop of 60%. When looking at the impact this has, I turn to my wife as an accountant and says, what did the CSO, where did they get this depreciation line from? I don't really know where it comes from. So she spoke for 5 minutes. I heard two words, straight line, the rest of it sort of went over my head. Didn't know what she was talking about. It seemed sensible and she seemed to know what she was going on about. So when getting depreciation, all I basically drew was a straight line. So put it across. She did look disapprovingly, but walked away. So we can see that what will happen over time when the amount of capital investment declines, that not only do we have a business sector that has its capital stock declining, a household sector that has simply stopped investing, the government sector is pretty much on planning on getting into the same situation over the next number of years as well, given the drops we see here. So the issue is, looking at this, are we putting ourselves in a negative position? Forget that one for 1 minute. So we'll change the shape of the slides and look at it more externally. How do we compare to other Eurozone countries? So this graph has a lot of noise, but it's just basically the Eurozone countries and their investment as a percentage of GDP. It also includes two additional countries. Denmark should be there, a small country outside the Eurozone, though their interest rate policy is largely in line with the ECB rate, and our nearest neighbour, the UK. So this is an average from the period when our GDP was increasing. So it's investment as a proportion of GDP from 2002 to 2007. What we're largely interested in is the position of Ireland. So over that six-year period, Ireland ranked sixth. And we can get the breakdown and we look at the different investments that took place, but we've already seen who was doing most of the investment. So the 17 countries, their Malta's at the bottom because they don't have anybody to collect the data. Given the small size of the economy, they don't send the data to Eurostat, but all other countries contribute. But in some cases, the series aren't complete. So while it is an average over the 6 years, I wouldn't be depending on my life on the validity of the numbers, because some of the countries only have 3 or 4 observations. But for Ireland, it starts in 2002 and does for most of the main countries. So if you rank it by overall investment as a proportion of GDP, we come in fifth. If we rank it relative to government investment, we come in second. So this is just changing the order and changing the ranking. The blue being government investment as a proportion of GDP. So only Estonia had a higher proportion. So our government investment relative to GDP was quite high. If we rank it relative to the household sector, we also appear quite high. So the only change here is that it's relative to the household sector. And finally, just the business sector, we come third from the end. So you rank it, Estonia has the largest red bar there, Slovakia, Slovenia. If you look at business investment, investment from corporations, financial and non-financial as a percentage of GDP, we were third last. So we had very high investment as a portion of GDP in the Euros on average, but for two categories, for the government and for the households. From the business sector, investment was quite low and we're right down towards the bottom. So in an aggregate sense, we'd say, look, lots of investment taking place. If you look at the particular sectors in which it's occurring, there is a difference. Two sectors taking us up near the top, one sector dragging us down towards the bottom. And if you look at what's happening in the last 3 years, so this is the average for 2008 to 2010. So for the previous 6 years, we're up towards the top. For the last 3 years, we've gone to second last. So the UK was the only country that had a lower proportion of investment as a percentage of GDP. And it's clear in 2011 and in 2012 and perhaps 2013, we're going to be last. That investment will drop and fall below that. So the issue, if we get back to the original one, is what are we getting for it? So this is just a blow up of the previous slide, which is where we'd like to finish. Even with our investment so low, it's still staying quite high for the state. So government investment, the blue bar there, is still quite high. So although we're planning to drop relative to the Eurozone, we're still staying quite high. So we'll still be in or around the EU average. If we look at the expenditure for the on GDP, there's the EU average for the last 9 years. This is what we're planning to do. So we are introducing cuts, but maybe not below the EU average. So the issue is, what do we spend our public capital expenditure on? Well, 2/3 of it goes through local authorities. 1/3 goes through central government. And local authorities, about 1/4 of our investment goes on roads, or has up to now. 1/5 goes on the local authority housing stock. And 1/10 goes on the water treatment and water delivery systems. So that gets us up to about 55 or 60% of total investment by the state. What comes through centrally is building of schools, building of hospitals, and building of railways. So 2 out of 3 perhaps ain't bad for being useful. So in terms of the investment, we are planning to cut it hugely. And the issue is it an appropriate tactic to make? Is it one that's been forced on us? Or is these cuts in capital expenditure actually going to harm us in the long run? If we're trying to make budgetary adjustments and we focus all our attention on the capital budget, say, look, we'll cut that, and we'll wait and see, will the current budget come into line? Is that going to leave us in a strong position? If the crisis is temporary, be over in a couple of years, that strategy may be successful and you can get back to previous levels of investment. But if the crisis is more ongoing and we face tighter controls, are we ever going to get back into a position where we have a greater freedom on the capital side? So over a 27-year period up to 2010, we spent about 12 euro out of every 100 the government spend on voted expenditure, but on the capital side. So roughly an 88-12 split. Last year, it was 92-8. So a greater emphasis on current expenditure. And over the next 4 years, it's going to be 6 versus 94. So the current budget is eating more and more of the proportion of voted government expenditure. This excludes anything to do with interest. It excludes anything to do with the banks. It's just the money the government spends on departments and government services. If we kept capital expenditure at the long run average for this year, it'd be over 6.5 billion. As it is, we plan to set capital expenditure at 4 billion. So much of the focus has been on the capital side in terms of cuts, in terms of reducing expenditure, and any improvements in the budgetary balance situation relative to previous years, where they take out all the banks, is on the capital side. So is the crisis temporary or permanent? So the last slide, the last picture, is the current account. If we don't get an improvement in the current account and continue to borrow for current purposes, Ronan made the point about borrowing for current purposes, that greatly reduces our ability to borrow for capital purposes, which should be beneficial, should be productive, and allows for greater scope. But over the last 3 years, we've made little or no improvement on the current account balance. So those three lines at the bottom are 2009, 2010, 2011. Basically a comparison between government tax revenue and government current expenditure. And the improvement is slight. For 2011, we're a bit above 2010, but not by a whole pile. So while the budget, or the balance, the deficit, excuse me, has some suggestions of improving, it is primarily on the capital side. We're cutting and cutting hugely from the capital side, getting to the stage where as an economy, there would be no improvement or increase in the capital stock. Whereas on the current side, while there has been adjustments, they basically have been to keep the carnage as bad as it has been, rather than seeing any improvement. So the issue is, what type of decisions do we want to make? So just to conclude, what elements in the current account if we were to try and improve capital expenditure, could we transfer money from one source of expenditure to the other? It's pretty easy to stand up on a platform and say you should do this, that, or the other. Clearly, most of these are political decisions, but perhaps there is scope in the level of expenditure we have, rather than having to actually increase it much further, to transfer money from one to the other. So you can look at universal payments, such as perhaps child benefit, the near universal entitlement to the medical card for the over 70s, universal tax expenditures, such as mortgage interest relief, the complete non-taxation of sale of principal primary residence, which is very low at the moment, but is a universal entitlement, which could perhaps transfer money from one side of the budget to the other. Like, the issue is, where are we going to get most bang for the limited money we have? On an equi-marginal principle, is the last euro spent in the current budget, the 94th euro, is that providing more benefit than what would be the 7th euro in the capital budget? So we have made changes, but perhaps we're focusing a lot on the short term, a lot of the targets that have been set for us. Perhaps we should have maybe a longer term perspective. And the issue is, do we really have time for a longer term perspective? When looking at the banking details earlier on, like, some of the figures are fairly scary, and we are particularly in the most difficult place. But I think we should have sort of discussion, rather than trying to meet targets, what it is we're trying to achieve. So thanks very much.
Okay, well, thanks very much, and I want to add a little bit of, I suppose, microeconomic content to what James just been saying about the capital program. And it's true that a lot of the fiscal adjustment here the last few years has been on the capital side. A couple of preliminary points, though. That was going to happen anyway. I mean, let's suppose that the banks didn't go bust, and all the rest of it. And supposing the Irish economy had avoided some of the worst things that have happened to us the last few years, we were still going to attenuate the capital program anyhow, for the following reason. Once you've built a motorway to Cork, it's not going to go away. It's going to be there for 50 years if you look after it, so you don't have to build another one. And it's important to be clear that there was a steady underinvestment in infrastructure here, certainly through the 1990s, as the economy expanded very rapidly. And I suppose a lot of people didn't really appreciate that there was going to be that expansion and increase in things like road traffic and demand for water and wastewater treatment and so on. So backlogs did build up. And the people who were engaged in looking at the various operational programs when we were getting EU money and subsequently at the national development plans were very conscious that the programs that were being pursued involved backlog elimination, it's called. And in the roads program, we underinvested. I think everybody accepts that in the mainline road system for 20, 30 years. But once you've eliminated backlogs, you don't have to eliminate them again. So I think, by way of background, it's important to be clear that even if we weren't unable to borrow and we had full freedom in fiscal policy, we would probably be pursuing a smaller capital program now than we were a few years ago. There's a popular narrative out there, and Seamus quite deftly avoided it, and rightly so, but there is a popular narrative which says that capital spending has collapsed, which it has, which then says there is an infrastructure deficit, it then says unemployment is high, so it says, so let's increase capital spending. And capital spending is unpromising, though, as a tool of countercyclical policy, and Philip was talking about this earlier on, and John, you know, what scope might we have for a countercyclical fiscal policy? And this has long been debated here. What is the true scope for countercyclical fiscal policy in an economy that's very small and very open, and where multipliers may be very low? It may be the case that in the short run, output and demand are to a degree independent. It's academic at the moment, since we don't have fiscal autonomy. But even if we had, people have debated a lot over the years
as to what the scope really is for a countercyclical fiscal policy. But let's pretend there is. What instruments would you choose to use? Well, you'd choose to use instruments that act quickly, like indirect taxes or social transfers or instruments like that. And it's not clear that, capital spending and the Fiscal Affairs Department and the IMF have done a ton of work on this down the years. It's not clear that you can manipulate capital programs sufficiently quickly to be useful for countercyclical purposes. But this is a bit like one of the early charts that Seamus showed you, and you can see there that gross domestic fixed capital formation, and these are at constant prices, has fallen very dramatically in the last few years. And some of that is the cutbacks in the public capital program. However, most of it is about housing. And these figures show on the top row, they're nominal, gross domestic fixed capital formation. And you can see that it's fallen from 44 billion nearly in 2005 to about 18 billion last year, and probably a little further fall this year. But the dwellings, the fall in the dwellings component is where the action is. It was 20 billion, it was nearly half the total in 2005, and Seamus mentioned this, and it's fallen to just about 4.5 billion last year, and I think when we see the figures, will have fallen again this year in all likelihood. So if you subtract one from the other, and let's just pretend that dwellings are a consumer good for the moment, which may not be a million miles from what a lot of people thought to be the case, and subtract them out, and what's left is, we'll call it CapEx. And you can see that that's fallen too, and it's fallen quite a lot, but it's fallen by less than the total for gross capital formation. And the bottom two rows express these numbers as percentages of GDP. And capital formation was 27% of GDP in 2005 and 6. That is very high. I mean, that is a really very high figure by international standards. Most Western European countries growing at a normal sort of a rate would expect to have gross capital formation at numbers like 18, 20% of GDP, that sort of figure. Indeed, some of them are a bit lower than that. So we had an exceptionally large rate of capital formation in those years. And those of you who are as old as me and whose memories are still functioning will recall that we did exactly the same thing in the period 1979, 80, 81, and 82. I think I'm right in saying that the gross capital formation hit 30% of GDP briefly around that time. And the construction industry was as, they were as happy as sandboys briefly. And of course, we ended up cutting the capital program quite a lot towards the end of the 1980s because the money ran out. So this country has a long record of feast or famine in the construction end in particular, and more generally in capital formation. The bottom row of this table, though, I think is interesting. And this is capital expenditure other than for dwellings as a percentage of GDP. And you can see that it fell up to 2010, but didn't fall by as much. The absolute fall in capital formation as a percentage of GDP is 15 points over that period. In the other stuff, which I've called CapEx, which we can kind of call, let's say, productive investment, it's fallen, but it's only fallen by 5 GDP points. There's one small wrinkle in these numbers as well that Seamus mentioned briefly, and I haven't quite got to the bottom of it. But these tables, these numbers are from demand tables rather than output tables in national accounts, and they include taxes, which means they include, Seamus mentioned this, the costs involved in the transfer of dwellings, which means stamp duty, really, doesn't it? So that number in 2005, from memory, was three and a half billion, and it's collapsed to a few hundred million. So if you take that out, which I think you should, and ideally you'd like to get these numbers, but we don't have them from one of the output-based tables, the fall in the bottom row would actually look to be even a little bit less. Which is not to say that it hasn't fallen, but looking at the gross capital formation figures, I think is a little bit misleading. This is a chart which is actually from the report of the State Assets Committee, and it's a chart that I really think people need to focus a little bit on it. The National Development Plan was put together in the year 2004-05. And capital programs are multi-year programs. Projects are multi-year projects. You can't really switch them off in a hurry. And at that time, and it's explicit in the NDP, it was assumed that real GDP was going to grow at 4 or 4.5% forever, right? And that's what the blue line shows. The red line shows what did happen in earlier years, and the blue line shows what would have happened and would have continued to happen forever if the assumptions in the National Development Plan had been, had turned out to be realistic. That didn't happen. What did happen is the red line. And the red line is a collapse that has occurred in real GNP in the period since. I've put in the upswing there, that is whatever it said in, I think, budget 2010 or official forecasts at the time. And the official forecasts have changed a little bit, but so what? Now, the gap between those two lines is really very big. And people are conscious that real output and real income and overall activity in the economy is down 15% or 16% from its peak. That's true. But a lot of our investment planning was based on the idea that it would continue, that output and activity and the demand for infrastructure would not flatten out, but would continue to trundle up at 4 or 4.5% forever. So the gap that you need to concentrate on is the gap between what was expected to happen and what is now more likely to happen. And that gap, and it's a forecast, but it is of the order of 40% in a few years' time. So we're now planning infrastructure provision for a future economy that is smaller than what we had planned for before by a very, very large amount. And I think people have to be realistic about that when they go on rattling on about infrastructure deficits. This is a comment from the Capital Spending Review that was released by the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform before Christmas. Over the past decade or so, $70 billion has been invested in infrastructure and the productive sector, they mean by the Exchequer Capital Programme. Judged by a range of measures, the quality and quantity of the country's stock of infrastructure has been considerably augmented in recent years, and I think it's kind of hard to argue with that. And they also quote in the same document an opinion survey of business executives. It's a perception survey that is included each year in the World Competitiveness Yearbook. And it shows opinions on infrastructure in Ireland. And it's interesting. Score out of 10, went from 4.5, 490, 496, 7, nearly 8. The perception that was out there, and that I think was reasonable, 7 or 8 years ago, that we had very serious infrastructure constraints, a lot of traffic jams in Dublin, and all that kind of stuff, a lot of the national road improvements hadn't been completed, and a lot of sections weren't open. But things have really changed very quickly. So I'm not saying that there aren't infrastructure problems left out there. There are, certainly in the water area. We still have school stock that's not in great condition. But we've got spare infrastructure in a load of areas. I mean, anybody who's been through Cork Airport recently will know what I'm talking about. And Dublin Airport has capacity about double the current passenger throughput. Because the people in charge of investing in airports spent rather more money than the regulator told them to. But anyway. These are some numbers on journey times on the National Route Network. Some of us can remember taking 4.5 hours to get to Cork and 5 hours to get to Cork. It's not that long ago. It says here 2 hours and 30 minutes from the M50, I got from the Mad Cow roundabout to Doncattle in 2 hours without breaking the speed limit, not so long ago. So I think it's even a wee bit better than that. Okay. I want to say a few things about this connection that people make between capital spending and jobs. Aside from house building and a small number of other things, capital spending on construction is not labor intensive. And Edgar Morgenroth has written a couple of ESRI papers about this, citing papers that the ESRI wrote and that some of my colleagues in DKM wrote back in the 1990s, long time, 20 years ago, pointing out that per million that you spend, the number of jobs involved in construction is less than you think. Partly because a lot of the construction projects involve heavy imports of equipment and things like that, and partly because people do not build stuff by hand anymore. And a lot of the popular impressions of how labor-intensive construction is are formed by people who haven't been near a building site for a very long time. It's also the case that capital spending is not suited to a counter-cyclical role. And you hear this being chanted out all the time. Why don't we employ a few fellas to build a few things? There's so many people out of work. Big projects have 10-year lead times, and they do. The National Roads Authority, okay, they have plenty of pipeline stuff now that they've had to defer. But if you ask the engineers in the NRA, if I came along with a brand new road that you'd never thought of before and that you hadn't planned to build, and I said, there's the money, how quick can you have it opened? The answer is 10 years. Now, the things that take that long are of no value whatsoever for counter-cyclical purposes. And the Department of Education will tell you if you ask them, if you told them to build a brand new school somewhere that they hadn't in the pipeline and they hadn't planned to do, it takes 4 years. They have to find locations, they have to buy the land, they have to get planning permission, they have to go to tender, and then the guys have to build it. So this idea that projects are shovel ready drives me nuts. Some PR genius invented this phrase, shovel ready, which is meant to conjure up images of vast numbers of people working on building sites. And this is a picture of the lads, or the survivors, I should say, because a lot of them didn't make it, on the Panama Canal. And, you know, modern building sites are just not like that. If you want to get a job on a modern building site, do not turn up with a shovel, because they'll expect you to have to be able to drive a digger and to have safety certificates. There's a picture of a man with a shovel, just for completeness. It's actually it's Theodore Roosevelt digging the Panama Canal. So I just thought you'd like to see that. Okay, there's a couple of points I'd like to add to what Seamus was saying. State capital spending does not end with the Exchequer Capital Programme. The state companies have sizable capital budgets, and they have spent a lot of money. The state companies' balance sheets expanded at a very impressive pace over the last decade. Now, you can say that's not part of the Exchequer Capital Programme. It isn't. But a lot of them are regulated entities, and they get regulated income through their national monopolies and so on. We had a bubble in housing. We had bubbles in lots of other things. We had a bit of a bubble in state expenditure on capital in some areas, and the state companies weren't immune. The other point to bear in mind is that the PPP projects are off the balance sheet. The way we do the sums here, if you can get a PPP project through, the CapEx is anteed up by some private sector outfit, and they get annual payments for 15 or 20 years or whatever it is, which do, of course, go through the state budget. But the CapEx doesn't, so it's an off-balance sheet maneuver, and it understates the amount of state expenditure that there really is on capital projects. This is the conclusion of the UK's Treasury Select Committee on PFI, they call it in Britain. The price of finance is significantly higher with the PFI. The financial cost of repaying the capital investment is considerably greater than the equivalent repayment of direct government investment. And they go on to say they've seen no evidence that this inefficient method of financing has been offset by the perceived benefits of PFI. So I think there's been a bit of a bubble in state capital expenditure. And people often say all these mistakes that were made over the last 10 years, nobody ever objected to them. Well, here's two counterexamples. There was 105 million spent on the Enniseth and Rye rail line, which in addition is losing 3 million a year, and it carries 8 passengers per train. There's 6 trains each way per day with an average of 8 passengers on them over that section. Now, Good Buddies, to their credit, wrote a report in 2005 which said that the net present value of the project was minus 137 million. So the polls went ahead regardless. There are now regional airports closing down because they can't be sustained. Huge amounts of money were spent, wasted on capex in them. The firm I used to work for recommended in 1999 the next program should not contain grant aid for regional airports, period. So these continued contentions that policy mistakes weren't warned against is not true. It seems to me that a few changes are necessary, and I'll wrap up quickly. There need to be ex post studies on major capital projects, particularly ones that have gone wrong. There is no tradition of ex post studies in Ireland. In the States, if the feds give you a grant for something, there is a statutory requirement for what they call a look back study. You must go back and say, was there a big cost overrun? Did we screw up? Did the traffic that we promised actually materialize? We don't do things like that in Ireland. We move on, in Bertie's phrase. I think there needs to be an enhanced scrutiny of capital spending by state companies. I think we need a proper review of Irish experience with PPP. And I think the Treasury Select Committee report last August is really very good. And we could do with something like that here. And we need a statutory base for evaluation and an end to political projects. And I think a proper evaluation of capital projects needs to be put into the Fiscal Responsibility Bill. Finance released a very good circular back in 2005 on project evaluation. It is just not implemented. It's not, properly implemented. So I think there needs to be some statutory basis for the review of capital projects and the prevention of waste. That approach was recommended in an ESRI report that Edgar Morland-Roth and John Fitzgerald and myself and other people wrote in 2003, which is a long time ago. So just in conclusion, I don't think we should be too bothered for the time being that the capital program has fallen back. It was going to fall back anyway. If we had all the money in the world, we're not going to build another motorway to Cork. I'm sure there are worthwhile capital projects out there, but the expenditure of state capital money here is too loose. There's a lot of money being wasted. There are still daft projects in the current program, notwithstanding the cutbacks. And the independent economic evaluation of projects needs to be placed on a statutory basis. There should be a system where nobody can get through a project without getting a proper cost-benefit study done, and not by the project promoters, preferably by finance or somebody employed by them, and put before an Oireachtas committee and done transparently. And I really think that that's the best way to arrive at a sensible capital program. And I don't think there's any purpose in trying to use CapEx for counter-cyclical purposes. Thanks.
With that, I think we can. I think one of the organisers is going to come and formally close it, but if we could thank the speakers for their contributions.
It's not a speech. Thanks to Stephen Kissel and Colin Harmon, who also organised it. Thanks to Fergal, who's just done a lot of amazing things today, and Claire Bilardi, who also have been running around doing all sorts of different things, and pretty much everything will be up on Irish economy, so please go in and comment and continue the debate, and we're going to do a lot more like this in the future. So thanks very much, in particular to the speakers and to the chairs who pretty much made everything. So thanks very much.